Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
This is Nancy Stanis for the LaRouche Connection. As of today, October 10th, the United States has jumped with all 4 feet into what could be the worst disaster for our country and the world that we've ever faced, an official war in Afghanistan. The objectives of this war are not to bring the peace, but are actually to try to wipe out a real network, which is a network of drug and terror, which is epitomized by Osama bin Laden. This network, however, is not actually deployed from Afghanistan at all. It was created in the late 1970s, early 1980s, by intelligence agencies in the United States, Great Britain, and Israel. It has, this network, been a drug terror network that has brought misery to people throughout the world, far beyond our own country, over the last 20 years. But the only way that it can be wiped out is by moving against drug money networks, London's support for international terrorism, and other political measures, not the war in the desert, which is just going to bring us worse and worse problems. The real problem we have to face is different. It's the one that created the crisis and horrible attack on the United States on September 11th. And the estimation that we at EIR have is that that was a coup in process, which was actually carried out with the complicity, the primary complicity, of rogue elements within U.S. intelligence and military circles. And this is what has to be pursued and taken care of if we are to prevent our country from losing its constitutional liberties and permit our country to join with the rest of the world in the Eurasian Land Bridge program, which alone can bring civilization out of the crisis it was already in because of the financial economic breakdown. What we bring to you today is the second part of a discussion which Lyndon LaRouche had with the Society of Economist Engineers in Peru. This discussion was held on October 2nd, but you will see that it deals with the background philosophical, intelligence, and economic issues which are vital to us in the United States as well as those outside our country dealing with this problem, the greatest crisis civilization has faced in the last number of centuries.
I have a number of questions here which reflect the concern of all of us here with regard to the international situation and the situation of our country. We can summarize them in the following way. One of the questions asked, Mr. LaRouche, do you think we are already in World War III? And in this regard, what's going to happen to the debt situation? What's going to happen to the nation state? Are we going to go into a situation where we'll have world city states? What's the proper role of nationalist military forces? Are we in the process of disintegrating now? And in addition to this, to complement this question, pointing in the same direction, what is going to happen to Latin America, Ibero-America, given the crisis today facing the United States? What do you think that we here can do about this? That's a series of questions which I'll pose to you in that fashion.
Okay, well, first of all, you have to think about the last century and compare the situation now with our experience in the last century, the 20th century. The world went through a world war, which was actually organized by the British monarchy, by Edward VII in particular, who organized the world, a war between his two nephews, King Edward VII. His nephews were the Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany and the Tsar Nicholas of Russia. And he organized it in order to prevent what a Europe at that time, at the end of the 19th century, was moving toward cooperation throughout Eurasia based on projects inspired by the United States, inspired by the Tricontinental Railroad System and so forth, such as the proposal for the Baghdad, Berlin to Baghdad Railroad and so forth, to break up that economic cooperation from the Atlantic to the Pacific across Eurasia, the British moved to start a war in continental Eurasia. This was World War I. There was a great mobilization of economies in the end of the 19th century, particularly after the Civil War in the United States, basically largely inspired by the United States and its success in defeating the Confederacy. Germany was built up on the basis of the U.S. model, beginning 1877. France was built up after getting rid of Napoleon III. Italy was built up by its reunification. Russia was being built rapidly. So you had a great growth. Then you had the danger of war. There was a great mobilization for war. The beginning of the battleship by the British. Other elements. Vast industrial and agricultural projects. So that the world came into World War I and out of it with vast industrial resources. The war ended in 1917, 1918. 1933, Hitler became the Chancellor of Germany. And we're back at war again, or ready for it. Now that's a period of less than 15 years. And despite the depression, in the depression of 1929, 33, so forth, there was still a vast amount of productive potential left in Europe and North America, and also in Russia. So that when we went into World War II, when we went into the depression before then, we had vast resources of developed productive capabilities, including agriculture and so forth, which we were able to call upon in the Depression for an economic revival and also to prepare for war. We came out of World War II still great power, great industrial power. The United States more powerful than ever before. We continued that way until the middle of the 1960s. At which point we collapsed. Now, we've had 35 years of collapse of the economies of Western Europe, of North America, and of South America, and Central America. The wasteland that exists today in these countries is monstrous compared to the conditions of the Depression, that is the productive potential per capita of that period. So therefore, if we do not have an economic revival, and if we try to fight over the dwindling resources which exist because of deindustrialization, because of globalization, what you will have is a condition under which the collapse of population through disease, starvation, and strife will be worse than hit Europe during the middle of the 14th century, the so-called New Dark Age. That's what we're looking at. If we do not organize a global economic recovery to reverse the policies which have reigned over the past 35 years approximately in the United States as a trend, if we don't do that on a global scale, this planet is going into a dark age. Now, therefore, what I said earlier applies then to much of this questioning. I've always thought, and I was involved more heavily in this when we had a more optimistic period in Central South America in 1982, the period of the Malvinas War. I thought at that time we could reorganize. I thought the United States would come to its senses under Reagan for very special conditions, reasons. And we could reorganize the credit of the Americas and start a revival of the economy of the nations of the Americas. It was very possible at that time, objectively. It's much worse now. We've lost much of the resources. Look at Mexico. Look at all the countries. Look what has been lost. Look at Argentina. It's a basket case compared to the powerful Argentina we knew still back then in 1982. Brazil has suffered great injury. Colombia is almost non-existent because of the guerrilla warfare. Central America is almost destroyed. Mexico is ruined. It's living on providing cheap labor for the United States, essentially. Its economic potential has been destroyed. We don't have the potential in the United States or in the Americas generally that we had 35 years ago or even 20 years ago. We're at a disaster. Therefore, we come to our senses, we can get out of this. The lessons of the past show us. Now, in this process, of course, the military plays a very important role. Remember, the military, modern military science is typified by two figures of France and Germany who came out of the 18th century. One was Lazare Carnot, who was a young engineering officer and probably the greatest military genius of that century, as a follower of Aubin. The second was Scharnhorst, a brilliantly educated man. He was an engineering officer, an artillery officer. You had a change in the character of the military, which in the 19th century, which came out of the idea of engineering, originally essentially a French idea. The ideas of people like Vauban, the people about Carnot, of the École Polytechnique, the ideas in Germany, developed around Scharnhorst and his friends. The idea that the military must be essentially a nation-building institution, which in the case of the United States, build our railroads, or the deal of them, whether as active officers or as retired officers. The Corps of Engineers was the typification of the U.S. military. Engineering was the basis for the military of France under Carnot and people like him. It was the basis for the military in Germany, and so forth and so on. So a military force is not simply a fighting force. A military force is an instrument of the state, which in a modern state is primarily an engineering responsibility, in the broadest sense of the term. Major public works, doing things on a large scale, mobilizing large efforts that the state must have done as the state, or as a part of a package of people who do that sort of thing. Retired military officers who have engineering training go into service in private capacities and use their skills, again for the benefit of their nation, but use it in a private capacity as opposed to being as an officer. So this role, obviously, in a country, particularly a country which is not fully developed, like Peru, that a good military with a Corps of Engineers kind of background is an essential way of getting infrastructure built, because if you take the army, the military, use the military as a cadre, a core cadre, for nation-building projects, transportation systems, highway systems, hospital systems, sanitation systems, these kinds of things, building new communities, fighting disease, control of problems. And that is the daily life of the military. That's a high morale military, not a barracks military, which sits in the barrack and smokes and probably takes too much marijuana or something, but a high quality military, which takes pride in its function for what it does for the nation, and can fight if it has to. And that role is probably more important in countries of South and Central America today than it was in years past. Why? Because you have vast armies of broken families, of unemployed, of poorly employed, of destitution, without adequate schooling. Don't you need institutions to absorb, to recruit, to train these young people, not just to become soldiers, but to become functioning citizens, to become parts of teams which function for the nation, which take pride in what they do for the nation, who then go from military training and military life into private life, where they continue that same attitude and that same morality? In countries like South America, where there's this vast armies of unemployment and underdevelopment, the military can play a positive role, not simply as a combat arm, but its strength as a combat arm will flow generally from its function as a corps of engineers, as a transmission belt, an organizing focus for the building of works of national importance and dealing with national emergencies. Take a poor boy off the street, educate him, develop him, give him a mission, give him a sense of pride in who he is, give him a sense of identity, let him do a period of service, and then go to the reserves and live in a private life, and do the same kind of thing. I think that's the role of the military in this time. And of course, I say in Ibero-America, it's needed. Also, the general other thing is the rebuilding of the idea of the nation state, of the sovereign nation state. If that's not a way of competing or fighting other people, it's a way of pulling people together as if a family. To want to take certain things and do them together to build society. We need that now. We have around the world, as the nation state disintegrates, as you have migratory mobs of people looking for employment in different strange countries, you have a general loss of a sense of personal identity among a growing mass of the total population.
Mr. LaRouche, what do you think of the role of monetary policy in the generation of public investment in the countries of South America?
I'm sort of against monetary policy in general. I think the idea of monetarism is the greatest mistake we've had. Look at the reality of the situation. What's the relationship of man to nature? Does money determine the relationship of man to nature? Or is not the relationship of man to nature a physical relationship? Is not physical economy what's important? Is not the productivity of wealth? Is not the improvement of the environment? Are these not the issues? What you need is a policy which we used to have in the United States. It was called the American System of Political Economy. In my view, it was the best model of economy which ever functioned as a nation for a nation-state economy. That of Hamilton, of Friedrich List, of Matthew Carey, Henry C. Carey, Paschein Smith, and so forth. This model worked. We were a protectionist model of economy. We set prices. We regulated trade. We used tariffs. These kinds of methods, which were the typical American system methods. For example, in South America, the great development of economy in South America came as a result largely of the success of Abraham Lincoln in defeating the Confederacy and in setting forth before he died the economic mobilization which made the United States the world's greatest technological power. This was picked up by the admirers of this in South and Central America and became the great movement for national economy in South and Central America. Much of the nation building that was done in South and Central America during the 19th century and the early 20th century was done on that basis. So the idea of the American system of political economy, as typified by Hamilton, by Benjamin Franklin actually, by Friedrich List, by the Careys, that is the way to go. The idea of a monetarist policy has been demonstrated to be bankrupt. For example, Russia has a very interesting experience on this count. Russia went from, in the most of the 20th century, from communism, which was proved a disaster, to monetarism, which proved a much worse disaster. So Russia has had experience with both monetarism and communism and found both one worse than the other. The monetarist the worst. We've seen the effect of monetarism as a policy over the past 35 years on the conditions of life of the United States, of Western Europe, of South and Central America, and so forth. It's a bad policy. I think we ought to scrap it. And I don't think that we ought to... I think we ought to be very careful about using the word monetary as monetary policy ever again, at least not for a long time to come. Because that's the policy which has done more to ruin civilization in the past 35 years than any other single cause.
No sé cuánto margen tenemos adicional para preguntas. Realmente tenemos un cúmulo de preguntas bastante grande.
I don't know how much time we have left for questions, and we have many more questions coming, so we'll continue. The questions continue to emphasize the concern that people have with regard to the situation, the international situation, and its repercussions, obviously, in our country. Among other questions, we have the following series of questions, which I'll try to condense. One of them says, So presumably war is promoted by great financial interests. If that is the case, what happens with nations, with the institution of the nation state? What happens with the United States, Germany, France? Why can't we close ranks to face down these interests, these financial interests. What role can countries like Peru play in finding a solution for this problem? How can we contribute? How can we change the mentality, especially those of our governments, because it's obvious that we're facing a problem of this sort. The problem are the governments that we face. These are some of the questions raised on this regard.
Okay. Well, on the first question is, how can large financial interests control large populations? Well, the large financial interests represent a limited number of people. I'm fairly familiar in the United States with a list of the names of the financial houses and law firms which essentially dominate the United States, which are what people sometimes call Wall Street. Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., these people. They run the United States. There are a handful of people, a small group. How do they run the United States with all our hundreds of millions of people? Well, how did the Roman Empire, the dictators of the Roman emperors, how did they control Rome until it collapsed? They control it by an instrument called vox populi, public opinion. The orchestration of public opinion and people accepting the idea of being like children. You know, the people, when they are enslaved, and popular opinion says they should accept being enslaved and accept pleasure or the idea of entertainment instead of freedom and dignity as an individual, what they will do will not ask for their freedom from slavery. They will go scratching at the back door of the slave owner's house and ask for a few favors. That is the behavior that you see in populations in the United States and other parts of the world. Worse, today, vox populi in the United States is orchestrated by a vast mass media program. Look at the United States. Think of the Roman Empire. Just the costumes have changed, but the methods are similar. See the stupid Romans, the so-called citizens of Rome, impoverished, living on bread given to them on the dole, and going in the arena to watch the lions eat Christians and things of that sort, or kill each other as gladiators. Now look at the United States. Look at our vast stadiums, which are filled with bodily contact sports and cheering crowds, insanely cheering crowds, for contact sports. Look at the amount of time that the people in the streets, in their homes, spend discussing contact sports. Look at our entertainment industry, our television industry. Look what's on it. Great drama? No. Almost no plot at all. Sex and violence, new kinds of violence. Look at the video games, which are turning young children into killers. Like Pokemon, Nintendo games are turning children of the United States into wild killers, mad killers. This is what is controlling us. It takes a shock to bring people to their senses. My view in politics is what I just described to you is a tragedy. Tragedy is never a failure, a result of a failure of a leader of a nation. No leader by corruption destroys a nation. Rather, corrupt nations select leaders who will destroy them, as the people demand it. The alternative to tragedy is, in classical art, the sublime. The case of Jeanne d'Arc, who was not a tragedy. In history, as in Schiller's play, Jeanne d'Arc was not a tragic figure. She was a sublime figure. She made possible the modern nation state. She, a peasant girl, inspired, went to a stupid king and said, "Stupid king, God has sent me here to tell you to become a real king." He said, "I don't like the idea." She set into motion a process which, after her murder by the British, resulted in the establishment of France as the first modern nation state under Louis XI. The Joan sacrifice was key in building the Renaissance in Italy, the revival of the Catholic Church in that period, the councils, the coming out of the councils at that time. So there are two approaches to a problem like this, the corruption of the people. One, you can sit and belabor and complain against the tragedy. You can say the people are destroying themselves. Yes, they are. I see it. But I also see that, as in the past, if we have a sense of the sublime, we reach out to the people, we try to speak to them calmly, we present them ideas, we present them with alternatives, we ask them to think. And if we can touch them in a time of crisis, and after all, there's goodness in every person, and if we can touch that goodness, they can rise to the sublime. Our job is to present the poor people who are poorly informed, poorly prepared to deal with this crisis, with a vision of a workable alternative. In that case, we can win. If we don't present a workable alternative, if we can't approach the people that way, if we don't approach the people that way, if we scheme and connive and try to manipulate, we will, as in every classical tragedy, we will be doomed by our own manipulations and our own scheming. We've got to come above board. The nation state is essential. If you look at the history of mankind, until the birth of the nation state in Europe, in the 15th century Renaissance, the condition of mankind on this planet was chiefly that of a wild or captive human cattle. Some people hunted down people as they hunt down wild animals. Some they killed. Some they enslaved. Some they killed the adults and cultivated the children, the young animals, to become... Societies were based, the majority of society were human cattle, managed by a ruling oligarchy, and herded on behalf of the oligarchy by our lackeys, bunch lackeys. This was the nature of political society from the beginning of the Roman Empire and Babylon before it until the founding of the modern nation state. The problem today is that people are being driven back to the condition of human cattle. And the way to reach them is how. You have to give the people this. And the Pope is the one person on this planet I really trust on this one. You have to go back to the fundamental principle upon which modern civilization was based, the principle of modern natural law. And that is, no government has the moral authority to govern as a moral authority unless it is sufficiently committed to promote the general welfare, the common good of all of the people and their posterity.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
The nation state was created with the first case being that of Louis XI's France and Henry VII of England after him, with the idea of the state must defend the general welfare of all the people. The law must be designed to defend the people and their posterity, the general welfare. And the state has no rightful authority except that. This is the notion of the modern nation state. When you take away the nation state, then you take away the instrument of society, the nation, the sovereign nation, which is capable of efficiently protecting the people, protecting the general welfare, protecting the future generations. Without the nation state, there is no political morality. And therefore, any proposal to weaken the nation state is an action which is evil. There's no reason to have war among nations. There's no justification for war among nations. We may have to fight a war in defense, but there's no reason, there's no nation on this planet which really has an interest as a true nation in warfare with another nation. For what purpose? Our purpose is to defend the general welfare of our nation and to have a community of principle in support of the general welfare among nations. Now, Peru's role is, in a sense, real, and it's also moral. Peru has gone through a very difficult time in a difficult hemisphere. The sense of dignity which exists in the Peruvian population and its institutions is an essential resource of all the nations of the hemisphere. And it's that sense of that in Peru which I think is its people's source of strength. And that source of strength is the resource on which anything good in Peru will come. It's a resource which will help to strengthen the will of other countries, which if they admire what Peru is doing and maintaining its tradition, will strengthen them to do the same. Weak nations on this planet, and Peru is one of the weaker nations relative to the great powers, depend upon what John Quincy Adams proposed in the 1820s. The objective of the relations among states in the Americas and the policy of the United States must be, as the United States acquires the power to do so, we must defend all of the nations, all of the independent republics of the Americas, for the purpose of establishing a community of principle, that principle being the general welfare, the common good of us all. That is the only real strength that Peru has, is that its people cling to that idea of national sovereignty, as John Quincy Adams, when Secretary of State, foresaw the time would have to come when the United States would be able to enforce that policy, that the nations of the Americas would each have their sovereignty and would be bound together by a community of principle of service to the common good, the general welfare.
I have a question which I think is very pertinent at this moment, Mr. LaRouche. You have said that the recent events in the United States have been manipulated by financial interests, which seems to me very plausible. But can you make clear for me what are the advantages that these international forces will obtain from these latest events?
Well, you see, you cannot overlook the importance of insanity in politics, particularly in strategy. The people behind this, and they were largely from inside the United States. There were a couple of other countries involved, not Arab countries. There were some people who were part of the Iran-Contra relics built up by Britain, the United States, and Israel, who undoubtedly were used as a resource in some aspect of these operations. I'm not an admirer of Osama bin Laden, who's a creation of the British, the Israelis, and George Bush. I'm not defending him. But they're essentially trivial. The operation we've seen in the United States involves a degree of sophistication which could not have been done by anybody outside the United States. It could only have been done by senior people who are experienced in special warfare and military command. That is, the minds of the people who planned this had to be functional on the flag officer rank level, or the equivalent in intelligence. This was a genuine coup d'etat run from inside the United States, probably using assets which belong to the British, the French, and the United States special warfare capabilities, which we associate with things like Iran-Contra. The motive behind this operation is very clear. The operation was motivated by a policy which is made most notorious by a former National Security Advisor of the United States, Zbigniew Brzezinski. It's called the Clash of Civilizations. Brzezinski, together with Kissinger, has proposed that we have to break up the possibility of cooperation among the nations of Eurasia. We have to go back to the British great game of the 19th century of intervening in Central Asia using religious warfare and tribal warfare as a way of breaking up the possibility of cooperation among these states of Eurasia. He called it the Clash of Civilizations. He said it's geopolitics. It is geopolitics. It's what the British monarchy did with Halford Mackinder in starting geopolitics as the way of organizing World War I. The motive for this is that people who see a great financial crisis are afraid that the nations of Eurasia will enter forms of cooperation with one another, which would create on that continent a focal point of power, which would prevent the English-speaking maritime powers from continuing to dominate this planet. Not just the English-speaking maritime powers, but that in the Venetian tradition, the power controlled by rentier financier interest of the Venetian style. Now, these are the families which I know well from New York City, from Washington, D.C., the law firms, the large financial houses, who have this persuasion, who last year in New York at the Council of Foreign Relations had a session, last July of the year 2000, in which they anticipated the possibility of a crisis of this type and had war games, simulations at the headquarters of CFR in New York to try to say, what do we do about it? Now, what came out of this kind of war gaming in the United States was, again, the revival of the Brzezinski Clash of Civilizations. Now, we don't know who the people were who actually commanded this coup. It's a nature of, I mean, some of you know something about military experience. You know how a coup is organized. You have a person standing next to you. You know him as so-and-so, General so-and-so, Colonel so-and-so. He also is Mr. X, but you don't know that. So the Mr. X's who overlap the intelligence and military community and the financial community create a need-to-know, very tight security operation and organize a coup as only that kind of trained mind can organize a coup. And when you look at the details of exactly what was done, what security precautions were penetrated, what were not operating, what the timing factors were, what the problems were of executing the operation, and you look at this operation, you say, that was a coup d'etat. Then you say, well, what about the Arabs? Well, what about Iran-Contra? How many people have fought as Afghansis in Afghanistan, recruited by what was called Iran-Contra? How many people are involved in the drug trafficking? Because drug trafficking is the basis for this vast army, the flow of funds for this vast army of people who've been conducting guerrilla warfare like the Afghansis in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is the biggest source of opium in Europe and Russia today. It's an opium war. Do you think that these people in Washington who would do this kind of thing wouldn't use those kinds of people as cannon fodder for their purpose? Do you think they wouldn't take the coincidence of the danger of a religious war breaking out in all Asia if Sharon or the Israeli military go the next step and go up the mountain to tear down the second and third holiest places of Islam in Jerusalem? This is the situation which we're living. And that's the way we have to understand it. It can happen. It did happen. And the only way you can defeat this is by taking away the advantage. If people are mobilized and nations are mobilized to say, all right, there's a coup being run against us. We don't know who the exact names of the coup plotters are. But we know the identity, the nature of the identity of the phenomenon which is behind this. Here's what their objective is. If the people resolve that no one will be able to conduct a coup to realize that objective, they can't take power. And that's the way I'm looking at it.
Vamos a proceder con las dos últimas preguntas.
The last two questions, Mr. LaRusso, as not to tire you too much, and we also running out of time. I have three questions pending, which have to do with the cultural and educational aspects. One of them is, do you believe, Mr. LaRusso, that the globalization process affects the educational process? Do you believe that Peru has a distinct reality regarding education than other countries? Another question on the same subject of education, and those of us who are committed to cultural development, what can we do to improve the spiritual quality of the people?
Well, yes, globalization is a danger to education. It's a danger to the people. It's a danger to everyone. What is a human being? A human being is not an animal. No animal can discover a universal physical principle. No animal can communicate the discovery of a universal physical principle to someone else, to another animal, even of its own species. Only human beings can do that. Now, I use the example often of the case of a student today studying some of the discoveries of Archimedes, which is 3,100 years ago or more. A student today, a young student in a good school, can reenact some of the discoveries of principle made by Archimedes. Now, the student is not learning to repeat the words or the formulas or the constructions of Archimedes. The student is actually re-experiencing the act of discovery, the act of genius of Archimedes. And once that student has successfully relived that act of discovery, that act of discovery, that act of genius, lives in that student's mind. That student, if the student is happy, will be so happy about having that experience, the student will tend to go out to other students and try to share that same experience. Now, that, to me, is the principle of education. I would refer to, as I often have, to a painting, which is in the Vatican Museum in Rome, by Raphael Sanzio. It's called, in English, The School of Athens. And you see pictured there, depicted by Raphael, a large number of persons, including himself, are meeting in this portrait of the meeting of the School of Athens. These are people who lived at different times. They were not contemporaries. But they were people who were involved with the ideas of the history of classical Greece and what came out of it. So any student who had gone through an experience in which all of these minds represented in the School of Athens by Raphael, all of these minds had been experienced by the student in the sense of rediscovering what they discovered, rediscovering their argument, that student would have all of these people living in the student's own memory, not as a memory of a picture, not as a memory of some words, but a memory of the act of argument, the act of discovery. That is what the model is of a classical humanist education. Now, this it has two functions. One is a scientific and artistic function. The scientific and artistic function is to bring our children to the level where they represent the accumulation of the greatest fruits of human history. Those great fruits are ideas, discoveries of principle, artistic and scientific, which are the contribution of the past of humanity to us today. That child should relive that heritage, not know about it, relive it. This does something else. When a child relives that heritage and comes to maturity, knowing intimately not only the names of great scientists, not only the formulas of great scientists, but has reenacted the act of genius of discovery which produced these fruits, this child has an informed conscience. The child finds that the person, and everyone who's had a scientific education knows this, or an artistic education, that a person you know the best is someone who died hundreds or thousands of years before you. As every Christian thinks that from experiencing, say, in terms of Easter time, where, say, the Passion of Christ, such as the St. John Passion or the St. Matthew Passion are reenacted, the person coming in that congregation comes out of there knowing Christ better than the person they met on the street that same day. Because they have experienced the Passion of Christ. They've experienced the act of genius in that passion. When you have that relationship to people of previous generations, of all humanity, you have a sense of the things that they contributed, which should have been done, which were not done, or the ideas they had which were not followed. And you have a sense that you, living today, might be able to do something to change the outcome of past history by realizing a benefit which that person had contributed, which had not been realized up to now. We also look forward to the future. You look at yourself from the eyes of the future, and you say, I have got to contribute to people who come after me what was given to me by this kind of education. And I have to judge myself and think of my life and my conscience in terms of how they should look at me as I look at these discoverers who preceded me in my education. This is the essential qualitative, the moral aspect of education, which must be preserved. Globalization, which denied this kind of history, this historical view of the development of the nation state, obviously has destroyed education. Globalization has denied the right of governments to provide their children the conditions of life, the conditions of education, where every child has the opportunity to develop that quality of genius, which is symbolically portrayed by Raphael's School of Athens. What do we have to do about it? I think we have to, first of all, we have to share, I would hope, the viewpoint which I just expressed. We have to share it with one another. We have to try to inspire people to see humanity in those terms, to see other people, to see nations in those terms. We have to mobilize in every way possible to approximate that kind of educational process among children and others. We have to cherish it. We have to hope that we can build institutions which will do that, in which every person has a moral sense of themselves, not as an animal in a jungle, trying to survive at an advantage over somebody else, or some other nation, or some other person, but have to see ourselves as having an individual who is at the one time divine and yet mortal. We're divine in the sense that we can share ideas with people who lived 1,000 or 2,000 years ago, as if it were only yesterday. We can look forward to hundreds and thousands of years to come in a way, the same way. So we find ourselves living, as some theologians call it, the simultaneity of eternity. We sense ourselves as a mortal individual, living as a mortal being in a very short period of life, but living as a being makes the future come, the past come alive, and brings the future into being. We see ourselves as a person on a mission called mortal life, of bringing justice to the past and bringing hope to the future. If we see ourselves so, then I think we know how to act. I find that thinking this way, which is a habit of mine, gives me a great deal of strength. I think that other people would find that that way of thinking also gives them strength. And by giving each other that kind of strength and that kind of perspective and vision, then we would say, well, the most important thing is to develop our children into adults who have achieved this and leave the future safely in their hands. Do what we can do. We don't know, we don't have the power to predetermine everything, but we have the power to do good. And if we do good, there's some benefit will come of it. It's the best we can do.
Vamos a dar paso a la última pregunta.
We will have one final question. Many of these questions will unfortunately be left unanswered for reasons of time. You can see about 35 further questions have come. Impossible, of course, to answer each one of these. But the very last question, I will join four questions together which relate to the question of security. The first says, what is the relationship of the CIA to the terrorist movements in Peru, Sendero Luminoso and the MRTA? The second question is, what about the situation of terrorism in Colombia? What is the perspective? What do you see coming of that, Mr. LaRouche? And the third question is, with regards to the terrorism, the relationship of terrorism and the drug trade in the whole continent, and what do you think about that? And finally, the fourth component, Mr. LaRouche is asked to please point out in broad terms exactly what his security policy is for this hemisphere, for the Americas.
Well, I think if we have a let's take the last question first, it's the easiest one. If we have the United States has the kind of policy I'd hope we can persuade the United States government to adopt, but I think it's not impossible. In that case, the hemisphere has no security problem. Because if the nations of the Americas are united on certain kinds of objectives, no one would dare or wish to attack them. So that's the easy part. So the point is, the United States must, as John Quincy Adams hoped, play that kind of role in respect to the Americas. Otherwise, I see no magic solution for the question of security. Now, the CIA is not, in my view, a very significant part of the problems of drugs and terrorism in Central and South America, not as such. However, there are other associations which are sometimes referred to as CIA, which are actually not. The peculiarity of U.S. law is that when Allen Dulles, under the National Security Act, functioning as Director of Intelligence, was also the Director of Intelligence for the CIA, but he was also the General Director of Intelligence, which included military functions as well. He then created a special facility under the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Defense Department, which was known as the Special Warfare Division. And out of this Special Warfare Division, all kinds of people, some military, some retired military, some all kinds of things, not military, began to be used. And this included foreigners, not just U.S. citizens, but people from many countries were used to conduct special warfare. And I think some people know what I mean by special warfare. The development of the terrorist movement, so-called, which, to my knowledge, was chiefly done by governments or by large financial institutions with the power equivalent to that of governments. That is, the idea of autonomous terrorist movements as existing is nonsense. Autonomous terrorist movements don't survive. They don't live to be around very long. Any terrorist movement that survives, survives only because it is an instrument of policy of some government or governments. The paradigm for this is the Iran-Contra operation, as it was called, which we know very well throughout the Americas, so forth. So is this special warfare section and this tradition where you have a mixture of official and private funds, and it was the private funding on the Israeli model introduced in 1981, which is the big source of the horrors of terrorism on the planet today. That is, you had an arrangement under which special warfare capabilities of this type, including from all kinds of countries, largely British, Israeli, and U.S. as the control, created things like Iran-Contra, out of Islamic Jihad and other things they got it out of, created it. As you saw in the FARC, as you saw in the drug lords of Colombia, the same thing. the other parts of the hemisphere, the drug lords, the terrorists, they were never autonomous forces. They were supported by governments, sometimes governments from outside the hemisphere, but known to governments inside the hemisphere. So there are no such things as survivable terrorist organizations. An independent terrorist organization will not survive very long. Once it sticks its nose up, it's likely to be crushed if it's not absorbed. So terrorist organizations are instruments of governments. I know that from the 1960s, I know that from the 70s, and from the 80s, and today, that terrorists are instruments of governments or financial combinations. Now, the complication has been the biggest source of funding for independent warfare capabilities, not necessarily funded by governments, but otherwise funded, who could buy vast amounts of weaponry and so forth, is what? Drugs. Without drugs, you could not have what is called international terrorism today. That's how armies are funded. You could not have an Afghanzi organization, the Taliban regime, without drugs. So that's the way the thing goes. And that's the way the problem goes. It's crucial. Colombia, exactly that. It's a drug war. You have this guy Grassa, the New York Stock Exchange, embracing the treasurer of the FARC, the biggest drug trafficking and terrorist organization in Colombia. Obviously, a case, financial institutions, and so forth and so on. So those, in short, I guess to make it as brief as possible, that, I think, is my answer to that question.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.